Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Animal Voices. My name is John Pranger, and with me in the studio is Marge Adams of the Vancouver Humane Society and Carl Loskin of Earth Safe Canada, and I represent the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. J.R.R. Tolkien was a very literary cat, and he wrote a poem about a cat. And he said, "The fat cat on the mat may seem to dream of mice, nice mice that suffice for him, or cream. But he free maybe walks in thought unbowed, proud, where loud roared and fought his kin. Lean and slim, or deep in den in the east, feasted on beasts and tender men. The giant lion with iron claw and paw and huge ruthless tooth in gory jaw. The pard dark-starred, fleet upon feet, that oft soft from aloft leaps on his meat where woods loom in gloom. Far now they be, fierce and free, and tamed as he, but fat cat on the mat, kept as a pet, he does not forget." We've got an announcement, and maybe my co-hosts also have some announcement from the Humane Society, Earth Safe. Monday's Brown Bagger, Diana Jewell, will do a live interview with Barry Zwicker, who is author of the just-released book, Towers of Deception, the Media Cover-Up of 9/11. Barry Zwicker will be back in Vancouver on Wednesday night at 7:30 at the St. Andrew's Wesley Church at Burrard and Nelson. So tell all your friends to tune in at noon on Monday, this coming Monday, and come out and support Barry and his important work on Wednesday night. Also, Barry is going to be appearing on Dynamic Health with Croft Woodruff. That's at 1 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. So please tune into that, too. That's 1 o'clock Wednesday afternoon with Croft Woodruff, Dynamic Health. Okay, I think that's it. Now we're going to have, in the second half hour, we're going to have Ruth Heydrich on. Carl Loskin's going to be interviewing her, and he looks like he's got something to say.
Well, yes, yes, we always enjoy having Dr. Ruth Heydrich on there, mm-hmm. on the program, and we'll be talking about her trip to Costa Rica, that wonderful place where they don't have an army and people can enjoy many of the wonderful ecosystems there. The country that promotes love and has volcanoes, savannas, and all types of animals, which we'll be talking about at the half-hour mark today.
And enormous ruins of men who, goodness knows how they might have moved those enormous blocks of stone around to build the buildings that they built, which were earthquake-proof, and looks like the marks of giants. And there are traditions in the world that say that giants once ruled the earth, you know, the Cyclops and the one-eyed men.
Yes, more about that a little bit later. We also have another really fascinating story because it seemed like the SPCA in Prince Rupert underwent somewhat of a correctional period here because they decided to have a fundraiser and to have boil some lobsters as their fundraiser. So Nicholas, there was Seneca Crossland from Penticton. They lobbied the SPCA, wrote to the newspapers, and it felt that this wasn't quite in keeping with animal kindness and compassion to throw these lobsters into boiling water. And so they changed their menu.
Well, they had to be
now,
reminded.
Nicholas Reed wrote in the Vancouver Sun on Wednesday, and buoyed by the success of having the SPCA recognize that food animals also undergo tremendous cruelty, there's a movement now that all functions of the SPCA should include food which does not involve animal cruelty. And if that can make a step ahead and we can have recognition of that, it would be tremendous a step forward in dealing with animal compassion. Many years ago, when I was a member of the World Wildlife Fund, Prince Philip came to Vancouver and we had a dinner there, and Prince Philip went to Stanley Park, and they counted the number of birds that and the different types of species there. And what I really recognized about the World Wildlife Fund was that the meal was completely vegan. There was no animal products, anything. There was no dairy products, no eggs, nothing. And it was a totally superb 8-course meal. Mm-hmm. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Carl. And what was that charity?
It was the World Wildlife, WWF, World Wildlife Fund.
And the SPCA were having a charity in...
No. That was many years ago when Prince Philip flew into Vancouver.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about your first item.
The SPCA in Prince Rupert organized a fundraiser and inviting people to come to a lobster boil.
It doesn't show much sensitivity, does it? Somehow.
Well, we need to cross the T's and dot the I's and see where we're going.
A lot of animals die in the name of charity, of course, and same with the Cancer Society. And how did these fundraising rackets actually get started? Because I do call them rackets. Well, Dr. Emmanuel M. Josephson, medical doctor, in his book, Your Life is Their Toy, he gives a rundown of the New York Tuberculosis and Health Association, which started the Christmas Seal Movement. And, you know, it starts a lot of... it becomes a foundation idea for such things as the Cancer Society, too. And this became such a thriving business that they and other medical groups started fundraising schemes for everything in the book, and have been doing a land office business ever since. The first one started way back in 1914, and billions of dollars have been wrenched from the people by their tear-jerking stories of the suffering needy. But little, if any, of the donations ever reached the needy. You know that 40% of this $5.5 million that collected this weekend to end breast cancer, which are already planning another one next weekend, so I guess it wasn't next year, so it wasn't really this weekend that was ended breast cancer. But 40% of that money, of the $5.5 million, goes towards putting on the show.
Really? It's incredible, isn't it? 40% administrative charges, I guess you would call them, could you?
Yeah. As far back as 1914, the fundraising gang were caught in unethical practices. The pilot group in New York were found to be pocketing funds that were collected for the needy and were using some of this money to actually fight the needy. That is, the charity money was being used to fight a bill granting pensions to widowed mothers. The fundraisers wanted to kill the bill because it interfered with their control over these activities. The various affiliated groups became known as the Charity Trust, and Dr. Josephson states it this way. At an early date, these organizations had gained control of the welfare activities of the state, and they could quite reasonably aspire, with the power that they had, to eventually gain control of the life of the nation through official channels or through the placing of one of their group in the cabinet of the president. This position was later obtained by Harry L. Hopkins. We wonder if this past 65 years of medical control is what has brought our national health down to an all-time low. 35th place for America as compared to other countries. In 1915, Senator Thompson presented to the New York State Legislature a bill to investigate the Charity Trust and force a further accounting of its funds. He stated, "It is apparent that there is a group in this state who have built up a very substantial and apparently very, very profitable business, as well as a political organization, out of charity. They have capitalized on the benevolence of men and women who want to relieve distress of those less fortunate than themselves, and to that end contribute from their private funds. The public, from whom these funds are collected, is entitled to know who the deserving people are who participate in the enormous payroll of how deserving each is. They should be forced to make an accounting." The Thompson-Meyer bill, providing for the investigation, was bitterly fought by the fundraisers, but it was passed by the legislation and then vetoed by Governor Whitman. Maybe he was in on the charity take. The publicity given this investigation made it expedient for the fundraising racketeers to shift the leadership of their social services or their social service to a new organization which would not be associated in the minds of the public with the stench of the Thompson expose. Therefore, the New York Tuberculosis and Health Association and Harry L. Hopkins, its director, assumed the leadership. It looks like they turned the wolves in to tend the chickens. The new tactician shrewdly realized that however effective their sham of a health program might be, it could scarcely equal the dynamic force of a bugaboo disease. They knew that an individual disease permits ruthless but effective play on human dreads and sympathies. This device is familiar to every quack, and it would be safe to say that most of the quacks are in the medical field. The credit for the introduction of disease exploitation as a social service device and as a means of tapping an endless flow of alms, and tribute from the public purse probably goes to Harry L. Hopkins, who tried it on the public in his New York Tuberculosis and Health Association, and it proved to be an instant and lucrative success for the organizers. use of fear of disease as a political device has now become accepted practice in medical circles. And that was Dr. Emmanuel M. Josephson, medical doctor. And they've used this same ploy to get legislation forcing compulsory vaccinations for school children, for soldiers, for employees, for infants, rabies shots for dogs, tuberculin testing for cows, fluoridation, water poisoning for all the states which have weak-minded, easily manipulated legislator, or officials who are willing to accept bribes for the opportunity to control these activities and sell the various poisoners. So from that nucleus fundraising scheme for the multi-million dollar TB Christmas seal racket, they branched out to garner more millions for the people for their other rackets, such as the Cancer Fund and the Heart Fund, Easter Seal Fund, the Polio Fund, Muscular Dystrophy Fund, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and on, crippled children, birth control. All these needy do need help, but they're not getting the right help, not the kind of help from the medical profession that they need and from the fundraiser, because they're in it for the profits, and the little which they turn over for research goes in the wrong direction, mostly on animals, because they know nothing about the basic principles of health and healing, so they can't cure their victims. Most of these cases were caused by vaccines, in the case of vaccine poisoning and other illnesses, and medical bungling in the first place, and the fundraisers are not going to remove the cause of the disease, as that would eliminate vaccination and drugging, which is one of their favorite money makers. I'll quote another doctor in closing. That's Dr. Robert C. Atkins, who wrote a book on amygdalin therapy, which is more popularly known as Laetrile therapy. This is already way back in 1972 when he said there have already been many cancer cures and all have been ruthlessly and systematically suppressed with a Gestapo-like thoroughness by the cancer establishment. The cancer establishment is the not-so-shadowy association of the American Cancer Society, the leading cancer hospitals, the National Cancer Institute, and the FDA. The shadow part is the fact that these respective institutions are very much dominated by members and friends of members of the pharmaceutical industry, which profits so incredibly much from our profession-wide obsession with chemotherapy. The health field is the only field where inequity, conflict of interest, and gross public deception can remain unchecked. After all, the people in the FDA and in all the branches of government that deal with health come from the same orthodox school of thought as the heads of the AMA. The damage done to the body by an unsuccessful course of chemotherapy is often so great that the patient's immune system never recovers sufficiently for him to stand a fighting chance. Chemotherapy, when it has no chance or only a remote chance to work, is at best stupid and at worst criminal. We're going to play a little music, and after that, we're going to come back and talk a little bit about a proscribed diet, that is to say, it's proscribed by the Cancer Society, who don't want you to eat this way, but it's called the macrobiotic diet, and it has healed many persons, and we're going to talk about that as soon as we come back with this piece of music.
And we're going to hear a song about muscles, and the next time you're at the beach walking around, watch where you step, because muscles are animals too, and you, when you're crunching around the beach, keep that in mind and walk carefully.
You're so kind.
Cause I'm a muscle, you're sticking to the rocks. And I've seen you clustered with your friends under walls and under talk.
And that was the Wildebeests with Blue Muscle Blues, and they're from Halifax, and they're great. And thanks to Molly for that, because I downloaded that beautiful song after listening to it on It Takes a Village. Macrobiotics, it's more than just a diet. Macrobiotics is an essentially holistic approach to health, encouraging overall awareness and self-change and natural, harmonious living within our environment. This article that it was published by EarthSave Canada in their August-September 2000 edition of the EarthSaver, published by EarthSave Canada. And this article concentrates on the dietary aspects of macrobiotics, not so much on the philosophy. And I'm going to open up the lines in case anybody has any questions about what we're talking about here, about macrobiotics, how to cook it, how to use the foods that are used. So any questions, I think I could probably answer them. Although it's been a long time since I cracked a book on the subject, but I used to cook that way myself, and I found it, after having gone through many, many diets and ways of eating and ways of thinking about diet, this one came to me as the most enlightened, and because it's based on universal principles which go way back in the philosophies of the human race. There is no single macrobiotic diet. Rather, there's a strong emphasis on the principle of balance and the balance with nature and the environment in which you live on this planet. So longitude and latitude have very, or not longitude so much, but latitude certainly has a very big influence on what sort of foods grow around you. And so it's important to eat seasonal, locally grown foods that have preferably been grown using organic methods. By the way, the phone line is 684-7561. 684-7561 if you want to call in with a question or a comment. If it's not possible to use organic methods to eat organic foods, then foods should be selected that have been grown in a similar climate, which basically means, folks, that it's okay to eat oranges if you live in Morocco, but not if you live in the United Kingdom. Other forbidden fruits include all the tropical fruits, but many people eat, of course, dates and bananas and tomatoes, which is a tropical fruit, although it acclimatizes very well, and so I would accept the potato and the tomato from being proscribed foods, because they are acclimatized to very many climates, and they grow here, so I don't see any problem in eating them. Of course, they need a lot of salt, and that's one way to yangize these foods, which is, maybe we'll explain that in a moment. Other forbidden fruits, well, of course, I'm not going to tell you to stop eating these fruits, but the principle of eating locally produced food is a sound one, as it saves transporting food about unnecessarily, thus reducing environmental damage and also allowing us to eat fresher food. Many imported foods are also treated with preservatives, of course, to help them endure the trip. So you want to avoid that, and you can avoid that by using local foods. The standard macrobiotic diet, as it's called, should be eaten by people who live in a temperate climate. This diet was designed by Michio Kushi, not the founder of the system of diet, but successor to Giorgio Sala, who founded the movement. And the diet is based on grains. Grains are the central feature of the meal, and beans are the secondary feature, and together they provide complete protein to the human form. Vegetables, fruits, sea vegetables, nuts, and seeds are also included. Fish is also included in the diet because it originates in Japan, and the Japanese did eat a lot of fish. However, and they only ate it a few times a week, if that, but it forms such a small proportion of the diet, vegans can simply leave it out without really compromising the diet in any way. The total amount of fat consumed by anyone following a standard macrobiotic diet is usually very low, around 15%, the fat being obtained mainly from grains, beans, seeds, nuts, and from the use of a little cooking oil. Mostly what's used is sesame oil for frying, and it can be used as a gravy too. You see, you mix it with soy sauce and it becomes a lovely gravy, but normally you use very thin layer on a frying pan, and a very different attitude towards oil that seems more prevalent today, that where people are actually recommending that we eat spoons full a day, and that was never the custom anywhere in this world. Anytime anybody has a question here, you go ahead and ask.
Yeah, John, what would you consider to be the most important ingredient in the human diet? Is it protein, carbohydrates?
Oh, carbohydrate.
Fats, vitamins, minerals, which one do you consider to be the most important?
Carbohydrate, and that is why grain is the centerpiece of this meal. Now, why carbohydrate? I think we just developed that way through evolution. And protein should be not a very large part of the diet, really, and complete protein can be gotten from these foods. And there's certainly no need to supplement that with meat.
Certainly, many of the vegetables are quite high in protein, like broccoli 16%, mm-hmm. rice 11%, potatoes 8%. Wow. And I always ask people if they certainly consider mother's milk to be the perfect food for the human infant, mm-hmm. how much protein do you think is in mother's milk?
Tell me.
An established 3-5%. Surely that should give us some indication of how much protein we really need.
And yet that's one of the favorite questions to a vegan or a vegetarian. How do you get your protein?
That's correct.
As if it were the greatest worry in the world.
Right.
And yet, really, mother's milk is very, very sweet. So you know that carbohydrate and sugars are what the human cells need for combustion and for energy.
Yes, certainly we need all of these essential elements,
yeah.
Protein, carbohydrates, minerals, and also we need fat.
I think that soy is the best source of protein from a vegetarian diet, about 15%. I understand.
Should be in moderation, I believe. Mm. And I asked Victoria Botenko when she came here what she considered to be the most important element in the diet, and she said that she considered the most vital element in the human food to be life. Does cooking add more life to our meals? Unfortunately, she said, that may not be true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and in the summer you would eat more raw foods, in the winter more cooked food, according to this this dietary theory. Most of the diet here, it says, is 73%, that is composed of complex carbohydrate. And we should stress the word complex, because simple carbohydrates give you nothing but trouble and lead to diabetes and various other complaints. Once the grain is stripped of its outer layer of bran, you strip it of many essential elements that keep a person healthy. Without those, disease sets in, and the proof of that is that white bread and white rice has to be, or white flour rather, and white bread, white rice has to be, as it's called, fortified. But it's only fortified with three or four essential minerals and vitamins that were taken out, which included many more. So really, the food is still denatured, although the government has allowed the manufacturers to call this fortified.
Yeah, and I suppose white sugar is about the worst, isn't it?
White sugar is the very worst because it's a simple sucrose molecule. It's been refined to such an extent that there's nothing remaining but the sucrose molecule. And in the body, it wants to make balance. So it robs the body of calcium and other precious nutrients, and that is why people's teeth rot. That is why skin goes bad, or why the bones become brittle. And there are many, many problems connected with sugar eating. When you eat whole cane sugar evaporated by the sun, it's a very, very different product because it has vital nutrients which are stripped from the sugars as it becomes whiter and whiter. And so that is one of the biggest problems of our society today, because kids, of course, consume vast amounts of this junk in pop, and in sweets, and so do most Americans and Canadians, which is why obesity is such a problem. Carl.
John, so you would say that we should look at all our foods and say, to what extent is this being processed? And the processing process takes out the nutrients and then adds them back and advertises that it's been enriched. But basically what we're doing is we're taking these B vitamins and the husks that have so much of the nutrients in them, taking them out of our food system, and feeding it to animals, the pigs. Certainly that's very much done in Asia. And there should be really a campaign against processing white bread. I mean, that's so basic.
Yeah.
White bread and white rice. That's.
But you and I attended the function put on by Health Canada, and they were very proud of the fact that they had produced this as a remedy for the refining of grain. Do you remember that? How proud they were, and I said, it really has saved a lot of lives and prevented disease. With the addition, you remember later on, folic acid was added to the bread, because instead of correcting the diet so that and informing people on how to eat and where to obtain the nutrients, they stick in a little bit somewhere else, in the milk or in the bread that people are doing. But rather than changing people's habits, they simply accommodate them. Mm-hmm. And they nourish and nurture disease.
That's correct.
Health Canada is not your friend. So 12% of the diet should be eaten as protein, according to this article. 73% plus 12, what does that equal? That's 95. So the rest should be in vegetables, seeds. Wonderful thing you can make out of sesame seeds is to roast them in a frying pan, then crush them with salt until about 80% of the seed is crushed. And it's like bacon on your rice. It has that lovely taste, but without the fat and the greasy...
John, wild animals intuitively prefer fresher, more alive foods.
Really?
And if given a choice, goats and rabbits or horses will always go for a green grass, mm-hmm, rather than the hay that's presented to them.
Oh, yes. And how is it that these large beasts can make these large bodies and only be eating grass? People think that we need to eat animals in order to get strength, and yet the strongest animals in the world eat grass.
2 minutes.
They point that out to people, and a light goes on, you know.
You're talking about the elephants, of course.
Yeah, for instance, or the horses and the cows and the rhinoceros And the hippo.
Big and strong.
Big and strong.
Why
and,
shouldn't we be big and
bodies.
Strong?
Right, and health. Do we have a caller on the line?
Yeah, we do.
All right, let's hear what the caller has to say.
Well, yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.
We haven't even gotten through the through our article here, and already Ruth Heidrich is on the line, you see. Now, what a welcome surprise. Let's go a little bit of music, and we'll get back to our enjoyment here with Ruth Heidrich.
This is a tale of a dog. Roll, roll. This is a tale of a dog. Roll, roll. This is a tale of a dog. Roll, roll. This is a tale of a dog. He barks. Bow, wow, wow. He runs.
And we're back. This is Animal Voices, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, and Ruth Heidrich is, I was just corrected. No, it's Heidrich. There you go. My German accent. I haven't lost it yet.
There we have. We have Dr. Ruth Heidrich. She's a PhD. She's an author of books like A Race for Life, Senior Fitness. She's been on this program many times. And she is a 71-year-old 25-year breast cancer survivor, has won about 900 trophies for being a vegan athlete. Welcome to Animal Voices, Ruth.
Ah, thank you, Carl, and everybody. Good to be here.
Hi.
That's nice. And of course, we put you on at this time because you were doing your exercises.
Yes, you had cut my workout short. I usually train for between 2 and 3 hours every morning.
Well, we wouldn't want Animal Voices to interfere with your exercise program, but you've just been to a wonderful country, Costa Rica, and you were with Dr. John McDougall, who you've said previously changed your life. So maybe you can tell us about something about how comes you became involved with Dr. John McDougall, and then we'll go on to some of the wonderful animals that you saw in Costa Rica.
Absolutely. Okay, it goes back to 1982 when I was a marathoner. I had been running 14 years at that time, had done races, and was really physically fit. In fact, I thought I was the healthiest person around. Found a lump in my breast, and guess what? It turns out to be breast cancer. And further than that, it had been there for years and had spread to my lungs and bones. After the surgery, I was scheduled for chemo and radiation, and John was talking about that before. This is where I really got lucky. There was a notice in the newspaper, wanted women with breast cancer to participate in diet research study. I had just gotten out of the hospital. In fact, I still had drains and sutures, and ran to the telephone and called and got right through to Dr. John McDougall. He said, grab your medical records and get down to my office. I need to talk to you. So the first thing he said is no chemo, no radiation. Second thing was you've got to change your diet. And I was in a state of shock because I thought I was already eating the perfect diet. No red meat. I had substituted chicken and fish and low-fat dairy. And he says, no, 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 none of those things. So I enrolled in a study, which he was conducting in order to show that this is the way you treat and further the way you prevent breast cancer. And as it turns out, all the other cancers as well. So again, 1982, and Dr. McDougall is following me as I'm running more and more, and then I saw the Ironman triathlon on television and thought, I'm going to do that. And for a short while, I was the oldest woman to have ever done it at the age of 49 and the first cancer patient to have ever done the Ironman. So I was getting healthier and healthier and fitter, and my life just took off. I ran the Great Wall of China, the Moscow Marathon, started winning every race I entered, and so I owe a great deal to John McDougall. And I think other people could also benefit from this diet because all the diseases that we have in all over the world, actually. The degenerative diseases, the epidemic of obesity, high blood pressure, depression, impotence, you name it, and you can trace it back to our diet. So when Dr. McDougall offered this trip to Costa Rica, I jumped at it. I thought, this is really going to be fun. And it was. It was just incredible seeing all these different animals. We had the resident iguana right outside our door, the room. Every morning we'd get up to go for a run, and there'd be the iguana, and he'd meet us there. Of course, he was a little shy. As soon as he saw us, he'd take off. I did get some pictures of him, though.
They're quite big there, aren't they?
Well, they're all sizes. The one living outside our room was about 3 feet long.
3 feet?
Wow. Yeah. Is that big or small?
That's a gigantic reptile.
Oh, they get much bigger. When we did the river rafting, we saw crocodiles and caimans. Those were like 12 feet long.
Caimans 12 feet long?
Or crocs. I can't tell the difference. Our guides could. I couldn't. To me, a caiman, croc, and an alligator all look about the same.
Now, let's just talk about a caiman. Just tell us, what is a caiman?
It's a variation on a crocodile. They have that same prehistoric look. They've been around for, millions of years, and they survive very well in countries where we haven't had a lot of cutting down of forests.
Right, and what do they eat? Did you put your finger in the water?
No way.
They're always smiling, aren't they? They must be eating well.
Now, oh, they were looking at us. You can see these beady eyes following us on our raft.
You know, I was in Costa Rica. I told you this little story. But we stopped at one place in this sort of a narrow canal. And he said, there was a whole bunch of wood debris on the water. The water was flowing quite slowly. And he said, look carefully at the water. Mm-hmm. And then I got this terrible, just unbelievable feeling in my body when I saw these two eyes, only the eyes sticking out of the water, and they were looking straight at me. But now I know this wasn't the 12-foot caiman, but it was keenly observing, and it keeps the bird population in check and all kinds of things, doesn't it?
Unfortunately for the birds, yes.
And you were basically, this was not only being with John McDougall, that's John McDougall, mcdougall.com.
Yeah.
It was also, you were promoting, in many ways, ecotourism to Costa Rica.
Absolutely.
And that's why we want to hear about the animals, encourage people to explore animals which we don't normally know about. And what other animals you had there was ocelots and
jaguars. What we saw probably most of were monkeys, two different varieties, capuchin and howler monkeys. Howler monkeys are, you can hear them long before you see them because they have this whoop, 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 you know, and they're jumping all over in the trees and they're swinging by their prehensile tails and it seemed like half of them had babies hanging onto their backs. These must have been the mamas. And they were so cute. Every time the guide would see one, whether we were walking through the rainforest or even on buses, the driver was always looking out for troops of monkeys. And one of the rides coming back from the tree canopy ride, the zip line in the top of the rainforest, he stopped the bus all of a sudden and uttered something in Spanish, and the guide said, get out of the bus, quick, there's a troop of monkeys above us. We all got out, and sure enough, just all above us, from one side to the other, the road was covered with trees, branches, and monkeys. The next thing that happened, they started dropping leaves on us in this one place. So we knew it wasn't just the wind blowing leaves. They were dropping bits of leaves on us.
Very aggressive.
Oh, no, entertaining you.
Yeah. Or saying, this is our territory, get out. But the thing is, it's like here in Canada. Some people are very environmentally wise, and the majority of the population is not. We're destroying our habitat, cutting down, clear-cutting forests, and this, unfortunately, is also happening in Costa Rica. The beautiful, beautiful trees that people love so much, and yet there are corporations that go in there and just clear cut, and all the animals have lost their habitat, and that they bring in cattle, and the cattle graze, and then they ruin that land because their hooves tamp it down so much that when the rains come, the topsoil gets washed away. So then they have to expand to the next tract. They cut all the trees down there. This is happening all over the world, not just Costa Rica, and we've got to stop it. I just don't know how.
Right.
We don't make all that paper to print all the bad news.
It's paper and it's furniture, but it's growing cows to feed people hamburgers and steaks, which turn around, the cows get killed, but the cows end up killing people.
So that's the myth propagated by Health Canada.
Yeah, heart disease, number one killer, and meat is the number one cause of heart disease, and cancer, and arthritis, and osteoporosis, and impotence. It just goes on and on and on. It's insane what we're doing to our planet.
Now, in the exotic rainforest where, I don't think most people, unless they've been there, you can hardly step anywhere. Like,
you can't.
There's got to be a path because everything is so fully grown. But within that rainforest, you talk about there's so much food for the animals and for humans. What
more
is it? There's rambutan? What's a rambutan?
Rambutan, yeah. I took a photograph of a great big tray, I guess about 2 feet long and a foot and a half wide. This fantastic tray, all of rambutan cut in half. And if you've never seen one, it's a fruit that's about the size of a large apricot. But it's got spiny hairs growing out, not like a kiwi. Those are small hairs, and they had lots of kiwi, too. But the rambutan has the spines that grow out, and it looks like something you could never bite into. But when you peel the peel back, it's got a fruit in it that's like a lychee. It's a very fresh, light, sweet taste, a wonderful fruit. We had lots of different varieties of fruit. Mangoes grow everywhere. There are mango trees everywhere you look. Guavas like most people have never seen before. They're big, I guess the size of a grapefruit, and they're green the way they eat them there. The guavas that I'm used to in Hawaii are smaller. They're yellow outside and pink on the inside, but these are big and green, and not everybody liked them. The people who aren't used to them, the tourists say, oh, that's not so good, but it's an acquired taste, and they're certainly very healthy, loaded with vitamin C and fiber and lycopene and all the nutrients that we need in food. They also had plantains. These are great big bananas that they do cook. They had corn tortillas, which they had a woman there who was just making them as we stood and watched her, and she pat them down with the corn batter and gave us fresh corn tortillas. Pinto gallo is the national dish of Costa Rica. Pinto gallo. One of my books is...
It's beans with rice and garlic, isn't
it? Yeah, I have... Chef is the name of my cookbook. Chef, standing for cheap, healthy, easy, and fast. And I've got Pinto Gallo recipe in there, and I had never had the original until I got down to Costa Rica. And it is so delicious. They eat this beans and rice dish flavored with garlic and onion, bay leaves and cilantro, 3 meals a day.
What's the name of your book?
Chef. It's on my website, ruthheidrich.com.
Let's spell your name.
R-U-T-H-H-E-I-D-R-I-C-H.
Heidrich.
Yeah, go to my website, and in fact, you can get any of my books there. And I've got essays. I'm going to put this essay, the account of my trip to Puerto Rica, been there too, Costa Rica, and also my trip around the world. In November, I went, it started in Toronto, to White Horse, to Japan, Egypt, Kenya, Prague, Iceland, and back to Toronto again, and there's a story about that on there. There are essays on why the protein issue that you were talking about earlier, that athletes need more protein. Well, I break it down and show actually as you eat more, when you burn more calories, when you work out, you get more protein automatically, and it's the right amount, so you don't need to add anything.
That's right. And of course, you being, when you were in Costa Rica, you were one of the presenters to the some 120 people on your eco-tourist. What subjects did you cover?
Just the athlete, how to be fit and healthy, and the workouts that you need to do. One of my favorite subjects is walking is not enough. But of course, if you're not doing anything, then walking is better than nothing. But running is the way to build strong, healthy bones and muscles. It gets oxygen to the brain, which is going to help you delay any loss of mental acuity. You know, I was talking earlier about all these degenerative diseases, but what about our brains? Don't we want to keep our mental acuity until past 100? The way to do that is to exercise the brain. And you do this when you go out for a run, when you appreciate nature around you as it is unadulterated. You get your heart pumping, you're breathing harder, heavier, getting much more oxygen, and you're keeping your arteries flexible. You know, as the heart beats, it has this pulse of blood that goes from head to toe, and that expands the arteries, and then they contract in between. The next heartbeat, they expand again. You've got to maintain that flexibility.
Bruce, do you carry water when you're running?
No. Well, it depends. If I'm doing a marathon, there is water on the course. And most of my runs, around here, this is blackberry season, and that's my water. I stop and pick a bunch of blackberries, and earlier there were salmon berries and thimble berries, and you can literally eat on the run.
I see. So
now, I know what you're driving at, that you do need to stay hydrated, and in warmer climates, or this time of year here in Canada and Costa Rica, it was certainly very warm, you do need to have enough water to be hydrated, and you test that by the color and the frequency of your urine. When you eat the way I do, which is just raw fruits and vegetables, you're getting meals of water, and I find that I really don't have to drink much water. In fact, if I try to push water, I spend way too much time in the bathroom.
I see. Yeah, someone was telling me how important it was to keep water levels up for the sake of your brain, especially.
Sure.
That, have you heard that?
Oh, yeah.
That's the first time I'd heard that one.
Yeah. Water is important, but again, if you're eating fruits and vegetables fresh, they are 90% water. If you cook them, you know when you put something on the stove and you see the steam coming up?
Yes.
That's the water flying away from the fruits and vegetables. And you've got to make that up. If you eat the cooked food, you then have to drink that water that would have been in that raw fruits and vegetables.
Now, Ruth, we only have a few minutes left here, but before we leave, maybe you can just tell us something about running in the Costa Rican tropical forests, and you come across some butterflies.
Oh, I had never seen brilliant blue butterflies, and they're flying all around you. They're so tame, they will land on your arm. In fact, there were a number of animals that were quite tame. They just hadn't learned to be afraid of humans. Running in wild areas is not without risk, however. There are snakes in Costa Rica, and some of them are even poisonous. So I was pretty careful to stay on the beaten track and not get too far off. There are even threats in the ocean. We did some swimming. I was swimming along and all of a sudden ran into something that stung me. First it hit my face and then my arms and then my legs, and I tell you, I came very close to walking on water. As I got out of there and was headed for the boat, climbed on the boat as quickly as possible and said, I've been stung. Turned out they called them water mosquitoes. Never heard of them. And they said, oh, it'll go away, which it did. But most generally, swimming in those waters is wonderful because there are turtles and all kinds of colorful fish. There's wildlife everywhere you look in countries that haven't been overdeveloped.
Thank you, Ruth, for being on Animal Voices. If I could just share one item here. I went to a wonderful place called Montezuma on the Nicoya Peninsula. They had big waves there crashing down on the beach, and one of these waves took my pants off and ripped it in half. not too much of a worry, because there were a lot of Canadians there who made a habit of walking around without any bathing trunks on.
Oh, really?
But when I had to go through, when I had to go through the little town, it was different.
Oh, I bet.
Anyway, love your stories. We're going to have you on again. And it's such a wonderful combination of bringing together your health aspects, and you speaking with the MacDougall, John MacDougall. So if you could mention the webpage and your webpage for our listeners, we'll sign off.
www.ruthheidrich.com. RUTHHEIDRICH.com. And there's an Ask Dr. Ruth on there, so if anybody's got any questions, they click on the Ask Dr. Ruth and the format comes. I would like to know whatever, and I'll answer you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for the other Dr. Ruth.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
And over to you, John.
Thanks. You're listening. Excuse me. You're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Cooperative Radio, member supported. Hazel, do you have any stories for us today?
Yes, I do. I do have a story. I used to live on a farm, and I had just a little hobby farm, and I have so many wonderful stories to tell, but this one here was kind of cute. As well as having a hobby farm, I had I looked after foster children, and I took in troubled teens, and I took in actually autistic teens. And one of the little troubled teens that came to live with us, she brought her little pet with her, and it was a hamster, and it was the first time I ever had a hamster in my life as a pet. And so we had this little hamster, and it meant a lot to her because that's all her only thing that she brought with her, her only worldly possession. And but you know, as time went by, like most children, they don't look after their pets, and she wasn't looking after it and not watering, you know, giving it its water, or you know, looking after it, letting it keep it warm and feeding it. And I was always giving her heck, saying, you know, you're going to have to look after this hamster because I'm tired of looking after your hamster, and I'm not looking after your hamster anymore. It's your responsibility, and you have to look after your hamster, and if you don't, it's going to die. And sure enough, the hamster died. She didn't look after it. It died. And she comes running into the kitchen, and she's just beside herself, hysterical, you know, holding this little dead creature, a little stiff little creature with its little mouth wide open, its little paws up in the air like this, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, you know, I got to do something, you know. So I started doing, you know, CPR on mm-hmm. this little hamster, and I started massaging his little chest, and she's just watching, you know, and so upset. And then I did the mouth to snoot resuscitation, and of course I'd never expected anything to happen. But then a little whisker started, a little twitch, and then like we were like, what? I thought, no, it can't be. And then a little foot just started, like, you know, a little twitching in the foot.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
Then we realized that we had brought him back to life.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was so exciting, and he did. He came back, and so we put him in a little bed that we wrapped him in, a little tea towel, and we put him in a little cake pan, and I had the oven on, like, really low. I said, put the oven on, because he was cold. And we laid him, we wrapped him up like that, and you know, he was in there for maybe 5 minutes or something, and he got nice and warm. And she never, ever did have a name for her little hamster, so I said, well, let's name him Lazarus, because he was raised from the dead. So that's my little story to share today.
There is a resurrection. That's cute. Marge, do you have a story to end up with?
I have a short story. Yes, taken from... Oh, I mean, I'll have time.
No, I guess I'm not.
Out of luck. Next.
So we'll leave you with this. There once was two cats at Kilkenny. Each thought there was one cat too many. So they quarreled and fit. They scratched and they bit, till accepting their nails and the tips of their tails, instead of two cats, there weren't any. And now we're gone too. Bye-bye.